On today's Talk of the Rock, we start off chatting with the Ludwig Museum Development Assistant, Jeff Garcy. He joined staff in 2017 as part of the federally funded Digital Inclusion Corps, which aims to build digital knowledge and broadband infrastructure in rural areas. He looks back at the program and what's happened during his time working with the villages. Then we talk with one artist who works with her husband out of a decommissioned cannery on Kodiak Island. We have Jeff here with us today. Hi.
Jemai, Kayla.
All right, so for those who may not be familiar, even though you were a guest on Talk of the Rock before, could you kind of explain how that works? I know you're working for the Ludwig Museum's development assistant, but you have been an employee as part of this other organization.
Absolutely. The National Digital Inclusion Alliance partnered with the Ludwig Museum to advance digital inclusion efforts in Kodiak. I took on the project in February of last year and have been working on it ever since.
How does that work out? How do you split your time between working as a development assistant and doing this national initiative?
Oh, very carefully. It's been fairly challenging to do, to wear two hats for the project. This has been a very challenging project in that we really had to kind of think outside of the box on how to address the challenges for the villages on Kodiak.
So I know that I said that you started in 2017. Could you talk more about how did they find you? Did they just pluck you out of some state, or how did they find you and say, okay, this is the guy we need for this job on this particular island?
Kayla, I left the Coast Guard earlier this year, and so I saw the opening at the Ludwig Museum, and my love for anthropology and for indigenous culture and the culture here in Kodiak and the island itself really led me to the Ludwig Museum. That's how I got involved with the Ludwig Museum. And then when they asked me if I wanted to take on this digital inclusion project, didn't have a whole lot of experience with digital inclusion before this, but it was something that I was interested in. And I think that it's such an important way for people to stay connected to the world that it was something I was very interested in taking on. And I could see the benefit that our communities would gain through the project at that time. So it was something I wanted to take on, and it was kind of a challenge, just starting from, square one. But that was also a benefit to the program.
So before I came to Alaska, I didn't really think about any of the challenges rural communities would face with getting internet access at all. And actually, as far as I know, we're pretty lucky here in the city of Kodiak, just because I've talked to other people from other communities, like in Nome, or our reporter Mitch worked in Nome, and in some communities, having Netflix or having the internet connectivity power for Netflix is an amazing luxury.
Yeah, absolutely, especially for rural communities, because getting infrastructure out there can be very difficult in Alaska, especially just because of the vast expanses of distance between places. As well, on Kodiak here, we have geographical challenges because of the mountains, the island. It creates a barrier between, town, where we have a fiber optic cable coming in, and the villages, to where we would, ideally like to bring fiber cable or find a way to get real broadband out to them. So that's a big problem for Alaska, especially because of the distances and that. And so addressing that and trying to find solutions is a priority for Alaska as a state. Yeah.
And also the villages, they don't have one massive line connected to all of them at once. It's they each have their own individual challenges to work with. Could you kind of describe what the different villages go through?
Sure. So basically when the villages are addressing infrastructure needs for broadband, most of the work that I've done has been with regard to educational institutions like schools and libraries. Right now, the schools are all connected by a Earth Station satellite-based system, and that allows them to have two-way video communication, which is a really cool way to communicate with teachers here in Kodiak or, you know, other places from the villages. So that's a really great opportunity, although it does have its limitations because it's satellite and basically the information has to go into outer space and then back down to Earth. And there, it does create a little bit of a delay, and there's some problems with different things because of that delay. As far as, you know, how they get connected, a lot of times it just depends on the telecommunications companies making that reach to bring infrastructure out to that community. And so having a strategic plan for our region that lists broadband as a primary concern helps to bring that kind of infrastructure development into the community.
Are companies out there interested in establishing infrastructure in the villages? Is that something that pays off for them?
Well, the Universal Service Fund is a subsidy that helps to, there's four different parts of the Universal Service Fund. E-Rate's one concerned with education, so libraries and schools. Rural health is another portion of that. And then there's also an infrastructure build-out that goes to the telecommunications companies. They get a large subsidy every year to build out to rural communities. When they get that money, they get to decide, you know, what rural communities they're going to build out to with that money, and that process is overseen by USAC, which is the administrative organization that oversees that the Universal Service Fund money, to where that money's going. So that process, you know, going through the telecommunications companies, you're kind of waiting for them to decide to build out to the community. What we're doing in Port Lions and an initiative we're working on there is to bring fiber out to the village using E-Rate funds, another section of the Universal Service Fund. And so we're looking at a project to connect the libraries in Port Lions, the Native Village Port Lions Tribal Library, the Jesse Wakefield Memorial Library, and possibly even the school to fiber optic cable from town via Terror Lake. That is a project that is in play right now, and we are we're getting all the paperwork together to send off the application. So,
just based on the conversations we've had so far, infrastructure as far as internet goes is so much more complicated than you would initially believe just starting off on the topic. So how did you get a grasp on this whole situation? Like you started a year ago, and now, I mean, you seem to know a lot more than when you began.
I know way more than when I began. So it's just a process of asking questions, you know, talking to the right people. I've had, you know, great people to lean on this project and really learn a lot. And, you know, I'm by no means the expert on this, but I have gotten sort of a holistic view of the whole scenario, and it helped me gain ideas on how to approach access and how to connect the communities that we're serving.
When you first agreed to work with Digital Inclusion Corps, did you realize it was so complicated?
Oh no, not even close.
When did it dawn on you?
Fairly rapidly after I started working on the project, it was pretty obvious that, like, oh, there's a lot to this. There's a lot of moving parts here, and so you kind of had to detach and, you know, take a look from a overhead type of perspective to get an idea of, you know, all the things that are going on and how the best ways are to move forward.
And your employment, that part of your employment is ending this month, you said?
Yeah, the last day of the project is on the 15th, and so we're just finishing out the project right now, writing our final reports and putting all that in. But it's been a great project, and I think it's brought a lot of awareness to the communities. We've helped establish some media centers in the villages. We had some donated Chromebooks that were donated to the village libraries to help advance access there. So that was a really exciting part of the project to, you know, get to bring those out there, show people what, you know, what they're capable of. And, you know, those will be usable with, you know, various levels of success because of the infrastructure in the villages and how fast the connections are. And so having those program computers where people can get online right away and just start learning, they make it very, very simple. That will be, you know, the effectiveness of those computers to allow people to have access will be, you know, ultimately dependent on the infrastructure going out to the village and the ability to connect those computers to, you know, faster internet, fast enough internet to where you can do learning on, you know, do digital learning.
And so when you first started out with Digital Inclusion Corps, what was the goal that they set for you? What was the goal that you had setting out?
Well, it was a very broad goal. It was just to improve digital inclusion in Kodiak. So they said, go for it. And we just developed a plan. And, you know, with the team at the museum, we helped develop the plan and put it together. And, you know, it's come together. You know, we've remained flexible throughout the project and trying to just guide it in the right direction to where, you know, we can see success and see sustainability in the future.
Do you feel like you achieved all that you wanted to?
Oh, no, I didn't achieve all that I wanted to, but I feel like I, you know, did pretty good as far as we have five different people working on this project throughout the country, and each one of our projects has led down very different roads, although all of them will have a sustainable impact in the communities. So, and I think we're no different that we do have. That this project will have a sustainable impact, and I think it has helped advance awareness of digital inclusion, awareness of how having access to the internet can have a positive impact on people's lives, and it has also I think helped people understand that, you know, that it does require training, you know, it does require a little bit of learning, teaching people online. So having libraries available where, you know, there's someone to help teach a little bit, even if it's just 5 minutes, like, here's how you get, you know, get to the training. And so that can, you know, that can put somebody on the right path to success. And I think in the future, having access to the internet, having the ability to reach out to talk to friends and family all over the world is especially important for the people in our rural communities.
And now that the program is ending, what's the next step for the villages?
As far as the villages, I mean, this to I well, that's a very broad question. I think for the villages, a good next step, or if they're not already in the process of, is getting their libraries LSTA certified. That lets them access grant money as well as subsidy money to help pay for the internet services that can be very expensive in rural communities.
All right. Well, it looks like we have no more time left, but thank you so much for joining us.
Kuyana Kayla.
You just heard from Jeff Garcia, who joined the Lutik Museum staff partly under the employment of the Digital Inclusion Corps, which aims to build digital knowledge and broadband infrastructure in rural areas. Next, Anita Shane and her husband are behind the Alaska Rug Company, which operates out of Port Bailey, the site of a decommissioned cannery. All right, so your work has been seen around town a lot. Like, I've seen it at Harborside very often. Could you tell me what it is that you make?
Sure, yeah. We take old fishing line and fishing gear and turn it into rope bowls, rope rugs, nautical stuff, and sell it online.
Okay, and so when did you get started?
Well, we live in an old cannery on the northwest side, and we started doing it about, I think it was 2010, so 8 years, 7 years.
Yeah, I'd be really curious to know more about that cannery. I hadn't realized that you guys operated out of one of those.
Yeah, we quit smoking one winter and needed to just kind of keep our hands busy, and there was tons of fishing gear there. It's Port Bailey. It's on the northwest side. And anyway, we went through some of the web loft and some of the lockers and grabbed some line and started tying knots and learning different ones, and put a few of our first items up online, and they sold. So we were pretty shocked, and that's kind of how the whole thing started. And now, of course, it's morphed quite into lots of other things, but that's how we got started.
And did you just find this abandoned building? Is that how you discovered it, or what was the story behind that?
Oh, no, we own part of the cannery there. My husband bought it back in, like, 14, 15 years ago. So, and it's just decommissioned. So it's just, you know, the fishermen used to have the lockers there when they would put away their gear and go fishing in different species. So they should just store things there. And, I mean, we have gear there from, you know, the cannery is over 100 years old. So the gear, some of the gear could be that old.
Right. Well, these are like historic ropes.
Yeah, some of them. Yeah. I mean, we also use, now we've been in business for a while, so we also use new rope. You know, some of our customers want new white pretty line and new manila line and things like that. So we do buy some new rope, and we will make things out of that. But the majority of what we like to do is, you know, find stuff off the beach, use it from the cannery. Also, we go to the dump every time we come to town to get groceries and supplies. We try to go out to the dump and go through their fishing area to grab as much as we can, or, you know, if there's anything on top someone disposed of. And yeah, we've been encouraging local fishermen, instead of paying to dispose of their line or rope at the dump or throwing it in the ocean, God forbid, or, you know, whatever, to give us a call, because we'll come take it off their hands.
Right. And not to stick too much to this, but how did your husband end up getting this cannery?
It's a really long story. Just kind of, he was retired at an early age, and a fisherman locally here, he met snowboarding down south, and they partnered up, and that's how he was introduced to it. And then, yeah, anyway, population is normally two there, my husband and I. But originally he purchased it to turn it back into a processing plant. But that ended up not happening, which is fine by me. And so we're on the mail route. We're on the mail service route and Island Air. And so that's great. So it provides us, you know, a way to live there and be remote and have our business and operate our business online.
So is this large empty cannery with you two tiny people in it?
Yeah, well, you know, there's bunkhouses and things, and we restored one of our bunkhouses, and that's where we live. And then it's like the old mug-up room and kitchen and stuff. It's kind of turned into like a guest quarters or a lodge. We don't operate it as a lodge. You know, it's just for family and friends and things. But, yeah, pretty much. I mean, there's, you know, three huge warehouses and big canning retorts, and all of the stuff takes hours and hours and days actually to trip around there. It's quite fun.
So is it all refurbished and everything?
Oh, no. Oh, no, it's falling into the water. I mean, not falling into the water, and I don't want to say it like that, but there's certain, you know, it's old. So, you know, there's only two of us, and when Ward's Cove owned it, you know, the big processing company that he bought it from, you know, they had a crew of 20 to 30 people, a work, you know, like a handyman crew, kind of. And just to keep up, it would take that many people. So, you know, it's a lot of work. We don't ever intend to process there again.
What's the square footage?
Well, there's like 29 acres of Port Bailey itself, and then there's some tide lands, like 50 acres of tide lands or something like that, where the docks go out. So I don't really actually know the square footage, but, you know, there's three huge warehouses that go out onto the water, and then there's probably another 20 buildings outside of the warehouses throughout the property. There's bunk houses, watchmen's houses, guest houses, like the old tech house where the laundry room. There's, you know, just tons of tiny little, not tiny, big buildings. So I think it was 29 acres and 27 buildings when he bought it. And I think that's how it was.
So where's the center of operations for your art?
It's actually in our home. So we just opened up one of the bunkhouses and took out all the walls, because, you know, bunkhouses, all the little bedrooms. We took out all of the walls and made it more like a loft. And part of it is our workstation. So we took some of the old grocery, big grocery things from the grocery store, and so they're big table, you know, countertops, and that's where we work. And but we have a web loft, the web loft where they used to, you know, hang the web and fix it and stuff like that. That's where we pretty much store all of the line that we would get from town or the fishermen or the beaches and get it cleaned up. And then when it's ready for that, we bring it up to our house, and that's where we actually tie the knots and prepare it to be sent out or bring it into town.
So what does it feel like to be just two people on this, with all these buildings and all this acreage?
Well, I mean, I've been there for about this. I've moved there December of 2004. So how many years? That's like 13 years now. And so it doesn't, it feels normal to me now. But at first it was, I guess it was pretty strange. I love it. I love living there. We live there year round, and we normally, you know, get off the island once or twice and go down south somewhere. And we always go and do the Alaska State Fair in August. So you get a little break, but I prefer it. The only thing that is, you know, it's just being in the food chain, you know, having the bears, not necessarily sure about, you know, when you walk outside, but I feel safer than being on a car in like I-5.
Right.
You know, so I like it. It's great.
Have you ever seen The Shining?
Yes, and my husband actually does the Jack Nicholson impression. There's these fishermen that have pulled up before, and when I first moved there, and they were like, they took me aside and they said, are you okay? Are you, you know, you're intentionally here, right? Like, they thought for some weird reason that I was maybe kidnapped, or I don't know, that I was there against my will. And I told my husband that, he just cracked up and he did the Jack Nicholson impression. And it's kind of one of our running jokes. Yeah, it's pretty much like that.
Not to, like, draw a negative comparison, because when I saw The Shining, what I got from that was, wow, wouldn't it be awesome to live in one place by yourself, just, like, having the entire place to yourself? That sounds, like, really cool to me.
Yeah, it is. It's great. I mean, there's, you know, highs and lows. I mean, you know, we see the mail plane person once a week in the winter. And other than that, my husband's very entertaining. So that, I mean, if he was boring, it wouldn't be any fun. You know, we have all the niceties, too. We have Dish Network, the Internet. You know, we have everything that you have. It's just a little bit slower. And, you know, when the weather's nice, we can boat to Anton's, and that's where we have our truck, and we come and go. But pretty much, yeah, I guess there's a lot of freedom in it.
Right. And it sounds like you have more niceties than I do personally in your estate there. That's like the most Alaskan thing that I've heard this week. To turn back to your art a little bit, could you tell me a little bit about what motivated you to get into this particular type of art? Like, do you have a fishing background?
No, not at all. I didn't even know what a cannery was when Robert had called me and told me that he bought a cannery. I didn't even know what it was. I'm from Pennsylvania, so I don't understand fishing. I don't like real. I mean, I understand it now a little bit, but I'm not one of those girls that would really go out and do it, you know? Really it just got me, you know, just from quitting the smoking and the necessity of needing something to do and needing money, you know, needing to make a living and to be able to do that by living there. You know, there's not like you can hop in the boat or a car and go get a job.
What's one of the charms for you being able to use these ropes for weaving? Like, what's something about that that appeals to you?
I love it when somebody emails me or whatever and wants me to do something custom. Like, they say, oh, I have this, you know, this space that, and they give me some measurements and, you know, they send me a picture, and they say that I want something rustic or nautical, and I want it old because they have a memory of Alaska or something like that, you know, and I can create which knot I'm going to use, and, you know, and then I quote them a price, of course, and then and it's kind of, it opens up a new thing for me because I, you know, once you start doing the same knot over and over, it does become a job. So it's really great to learn a new knot or do a new knot in a much bigger, size, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And who is your customer base? Like, how wide ranging is it?
Well, we, in Kodiak alone, we sell at Java Flats and Monk's Rock. And then we're online on Etsy, and we have our website, alaskarugcompany.com. But the majority of our business comes from Etsy. However, pretty much every major town in Alaska, we have set up with a store that we do consignment with. We just finally, we got somebody in Skagway. We have somebody in Anchorage, Palmer, Ketchikan, Juneau. I mean, we're pretty much in every, you know, major town that sells our stuff. So it keeps us very busy. I mean, my husband and I both work 40-plus hours just on tying knots. There's no doubt.
And I guess I should have asked this before, but where do you guys come from? What's your background?
I'm from close to Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, and he was raised in Maui.
Okay, and what got you to Alaska, to the state?
Well, him and Robert and I had been, we'd known each other for maybe a couple months and started dating, and we were talking on the phone quite a bit, and that's when he first purchased Port Bailey. And about a year after he purchased it, I moved up. I was kind of at a fork in the road. Do I go this way or do I follow my heart and go this way? And I chose to follow my heart and come this way, and here I still am. So,
Where is Port Bailey in relation to the city of Kodiak?
So I guess we're about 25, 30 miles as the crow flies. So, you know, Port Lyons, if, you know, you would come, I don't know how familiar you are with the water, but you have to go through Whale Pass, and we're pretty much the first major bay, Dry Spruce Bay, where Port Bailey sits. Before Shelikoff, it's the Kuperanoff Strait.
It sounds like you take a vessel out there.
Oh, yeah, you can only get there by either seaplane or a boat, yeah.
Okay. Wow, interesting. So how often do you get to town?
In the summer, probably every 4 weeks, because we have guests coming and going, you know, friends, and... but in the winter, like right now, Anton Larson's is frozen, so I had to fly into town on the mail plane. But if it's not frozen, you know, every 6 weeks to get veggies and see other humans.
Wow. All right. I think those are all the questions I have. That's so interesting that you live in this. I mean, that's just, you must want to write novels. It's just like such an interesting place to be.
Well, it's fun when somebody says that because, you know, once you live there, it kind of becomes normal. But now that you say it, like, yeah, I guess it's pretty extraordinary.